Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high quality continuing education and training for all UK registered optometrists. You can gain one CET point by listening to the podcast and completing the exercise on our website, docket.info. I'm Michelle Hanratty. I'm an IP optometrist based in Birmingham and a final examiner for the college's scheme for registration. With case studies and in-depth conversations each month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. We put out a survey to you, our listeners, asking which topics you wanted to hear about, and this subject was a very popular request. So this time, we're discussing binocular vision. When I hear the words double vision from a patient, I think, not good, as it can be a red flag to some sinister conditions, and if it's mismanaged, it can lead to abnormal visual development in children. On the other hand, double vision can be due to just eye strain. So getting the management right is important. Eliminating the differentials requires a good theoretical knowledge. Without it, we can't solve the problem. So it's essential to keep that knowledge fresh. Shortly, we'll be speaking with specialist optometrist Janice McCrudden to delve deeper into squints and assessing binocular vision in children. But first, producer Izzy Clark spoke with optometrist and self-confessed BV geek Neil Constantine Smith, who's a director of a Specsavers in the southwest of England. He came across a patient who experienced sudden onset double vision during lockdown earlier this year.
My wife said to me one day, my friend's got a problem with her vision. She said she's seeing things double, and it seems to be getting worse, and it's especially when she looks around, apparently, which, as an optometrist, always sets off alarm bells for me, especially if it's a recent onset, because that could be something like we call a vascular accident, something that's happening in the brain. It's one of those things that really needs to be investigated quickly as you can. So I thought, that's going to be tricky, especially during lockdown. How do I get to see this person? I was doing a lot of telemedicine at the time.
Yeah, and as you're saying, the added stress of just being in lockdown, how are you able to evaluate a situation like this?
In lockdown, and we were actually in the absolute height of lockdown at the time, and this is an elderly patient, so really she should be shielding and not one needed really to come to us or to hospital unless it's really necessary. So what I was going to have to do is try to evaluate her over the phone. So I got her to ring the practice where I could do a proper sort of telephone evaluation and try to do some tests over the phone as such.
And so what are those tests?
Well, her symptoms were she was getting things double. So the first thing you ask all patients with that, is it side by side double or is it one above the other? And she was saying it was side to side, but more when she was looking to in one direction. Now that indicates what we call an incompetency. What I would do in practice is actually get a pen light and move the pen light around and get her to follow it and tell me if it went double in any particular direction of gaze. So describing that over the phone was going to be a bit difficult for somebody to do. So what I got her to do was look at something of interest in the room, which turned out to be a light switch. And I said, as you look straight at the light switch, is it double? And it was a little bit double. And then I got her to keep looking at the light switch and move her head to one side. So as she moved it to the left, then it went single. She only saw one light switch. But then when she moved her head to the right, then it went double and the doubling got further apart. So I knew then it was a problem when she looked to the left, which then suggests it's a certain particular muscle, which is the left lateral rectus, which is then innervated by one particular nerve, the sixth nerve. And that then got me onto almost like the diagnosis straight away of what it was. But then we needed to find out the reason for that.
Yeah. And for you, why is it important to try something? You know, are there risk factors that we have to consider here?
There are a number of risk factors. I'd also asked her about her general health. Things like diabetes can sometimes cause a lot of difficulty with extraocular nerves and muscles and what have you. Asked her about trauma, if she did anything like that. Asked her if she had any other symptoms, you know, feeling poorly. But other than sort of blood pressure and things like that, there wasn't anything major going on that I needed to know.
And are those the similar questions that you would ask if you were able to assess someone, you know, not in lockdown? You had them there in your practice and you can see them face to face.
Yeah, I mean, the symptoms and history part of it, you can do that equally as well over the phone or as you can when it's face-to-face. It's the practical things you can't really do. You, let's say, manage to get to the point of it's a left lateral rectus nerve palsy by what she was saying. And it'd been for the last 3 weeks. What I was able to do was actually ring up the orthoptics department of the hospital. The orthoptist said to me, well, it was unusual to be getting worse after 3 weeks. Normally they stabilise after 2. So he was of the opinion that they wanted to see her straight away to do things like brain scans just to make sure that there was no sinister underlying cause for it.
And do we know what the outcome was?
Thankfully, it was nothing like a brain tumour or an aneurysm or anything like that. It was put down to, sometimes they call it idiopathic, but put down to her general health and medication and the blood pressure aspect and what have you. So hopefully, I've not seen her for it, it would stabilise and actually either we're going to give her prisms to get rid of the double vision or it might actually just resolve on its own at some point. But they didn't find any sinister cause for it, thankfully.
And in hindsight, how did you feel about the situation?
Well, as always, as soon as something that triggers off alarm bells, you start to get a little bit anxious of sort of, oh, right, where's this going to go? And added to that was the whole lockdown thing of, right, how am I going to manage this under the present circumstances? It was a good result in the end, but it just required sort of thinking outside the box, which is actually personally something I felt I really enjoyed over lockdown, thinking of my skills and what was available and how to do it. It was an interesting thing to think about.
That was Neil Constantine-Smith talking about a case of diplopia that was assessed remotely. But in normal circumstances, when we can examine the patient face to face, there's a whole host of tests that we can use to assess a symptomatic patient. This is fairly straightforward with adults, but selecting the right tests to carry out with children, especially young children, can be more of a challenge. With me is specialist optometrist from the Belfast Health Trust, Janice McCrudden, who's also an ophthalmic clinical advisor for the Health and Social Care Board in Northern Ireland. So Janice, how early can squints be detected?
Generally, I think a squint can probably be reliably detected maybe from about 6 months onwards. Infants and newborns can look cross-eyed, especially when tired or maybe sucking on a bottle or something. But generally, it's nothing to worry about at that stage.
And what tends to cause a squint?
I'll break them down into several categories. Generally acquired, which is mostly due or caused by an eye attempting to overcome a vision problem. If you've got a lazy eye or the eye isn't seeing as well, it then becomes, as we say, lazy and tends to squint or drift a little bit. So we would call those acquired squints due to trying to overcome a visual problem. And this could be an uncorrected refractive error or astigmatism or sometimes high myopia. That tends not to cause as much problems because children can develop to see it near when they're myopic. But if they're very highly myopic, it can develop into a squint. And generally, that's somewhere between the age of 2 and 5 years.
What are the key signs to look for if a parent is worried about their child, if they suspect that the child might be squinting?
Now, very small squints are generally harder to detect in young children than larger ones. But you should, by and large, see a squint. The things to look for might be a child not liking an eye covered. If you cover one eye and they don't like it, they're trying to dodge around your hand. That tends to indicate something might be wrong. Abnormal head postures. Closing one eye. That's especially true for distance exotropia. Also, don't forget to look at the corneal reflexes of a child. If they're sitting on the mother's knee, you can even tell by the lights in the room. You can get a good look at that. And your horizontal tropias are much more common than your vertical tropias, and again, eso. So the vast majority of squints in children are esotropias.
So sometimes if you happen to have the child in the consulting room, you can also look at the ret reflex as well, can't you? Because you can sometimes see if there is significant anisometropia, that the ret reflex is a different intensity between the two eyes.
Yes, absolutely. That would certainly give you an indication if the prescription was different or very different in the two eyes. Mm.
So those are the signs to look for. But what about the specific questions that you think are important to ask? Because quite often we get carried away with what we see and what we can detect. But actually, we need to take a step back, don't we, and think about the history. So what questions do you think we need to ask?
Yeah, I mean, mums, I always think, are really quite useful when they're in the room. But not to say anything against grandparents or dads who may bring them along. But when you ask whoever's with the child, do you see the eye turning in? Do you see it turning out? Which eye? How long do you think it turns for? When does it happen? When the child's sick or tired? Do you associate it with any headaches or anything else the child's complaining about? Those are the first things I would ask. And then I would go on to other things for, has there ever been any other eye problems? Because children are checked at various points. They get a check, you know, when they're newborn, they get a check at 68 weeks and they get a check at within their first year at school. General health. You want to know the birth history, you know, if they're good weight, if they're meeting developmental milestones in their own development. And then the one very important one you want to check on, is anybody in the family attending an eye department, had any patching, or anybody else that they know has had a squint or anything? In the immediate family, we're not going down to aunts and uncles and second cousins, but certainly first line blood relatives, mum, dad, or any other siblings.
So once we've finished taking a history, how do you go about assessing a child, particularly if it's a young child? I know in practice sometimes we are a little bit worried that we may not be applying quite the right tests. So how would you go about approaching assessing a child that you suspect has got a squint?
So the first thing I would be doing is a cover test. Practice and become proficient at a slow alternate cover test. Look for movement, get yourself some flashing toys, things that squeak, anything that'll keep a child's attention. Motility, I mean, you really just want a quick gross motility test. You can go on to your base out prisms, I mean a 20 base out or even a 10 base out. So make sure that when you put that in front of the eye, both eyes can overcome the 20 or the 10 base out prism. If the eye with the prism in front of it doesn't overcome it, it would be a sign that there's something wrong with that eye. So look a little bit more closely. And do remember that the 4 base out works well for checking for microtropias. And then I would go on to vision. I mean, there are various tests you can do vision with for children. Somebody under 6 months, the old hundreds and thousands test, if the child will pick a little bit of hundreds and thousands up from the palm of your hand, is still very useful. Between the age of 6 and 12 months, going on to Cardiff, preferential looking cards are very good. You know, the grating. Children tend to get bored with that after about 12 months. And then you might start to move on to K pictures at maybe a third of a metre. I personally prefer the single crowded K pictures, which many people probably haven't gotten their practice. And then as they get older and go on to say maybe 2.5 or something, you can start using normal crowded K's pictures and then work up to Keeler letters. And obviously that'll give you the most reliable result. And you should be able to pick up amblyopia or a lazy eye quite well for that. Definitely my cover test is my first test, and then, you know, work in your vision. And don't forget stereo. Your stereo is a very important test.
So if I have a child that comes in who's under 4, who hasn't yet gone for their screening test at school, but the parent is worried, I think I would probably attempt some form of vision in some way. You probably using K pictures. Again, I don't have access to the crowded version, but I think I'd still get some good information. And then I know what to use as a cover test fixation target. But again, even with a younger child, if I use a flashing toy, you're saying I could still get a good result using a flashing toy at near. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. What I didn't mention earlier and what we can't forget is refraction, you know, using your ret. And I'm a great believer in a cycloplegic ret, especially the first time, because you can be quite sure you have a result and you can say, yes, there's something there or not. And the thing to remember is in a 4-year-old, we need to be using 1% cyclopentolate. I know some people think 0.5% is enough. I'm not convinced that you'll get full cyclo with that. And for some of these that are maybe a little bit latent, you need to be able to make sure you have a full prescription. And the only way you can get the muscles to completely relax is the 1%.
Yeah, and obviously checking that they are cycloplegic before you actually do the ret. So Janice, do children with squints actually have binocular vision? Do they have any stereo acuity?
I think that's a really interesting question. First of all, it'll depend on the squint, whether it's constant or intermittent. Normal binocular vision would give a stereo of about 40 seconds. If you have a large constant squint, say greater than 25 diopters, the likelihood of any binocular vision is zero. If you have an intermittent squint that's breaking down, or perhaps a distance exo, but you don't squint it near, you might have 200 seconds, and a micro will give you 120 seconds roughly.
So why is it important to make sure that we spot any issues in children as quickly as possible?
First of all, I think you need to make sure that there's nothing sinister, because I mean, you do get things like retinoblastomas or children with cataracts, which need very urgent attention, that, you know, they will squint potentially. Other less common reasons are possibly because there's muscles not working, disorder of the brain connection, you know, coordinating of that. anatomical damage, lesions in some of the nerves or some illnesses, etc. And also, again, I think you need to be careful to watch out for high risk factors like white pupils or ptosis. So you need to rule those out first of all. The earlier you can pick these things up, A, you're ruling out anything urgent, but B, you're also trying to put an intervention in as soon as you can, which gives the best result.
Yeah, so really what we want is to maximise the potential for that child's vision to develop normally.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, Janice, so what about if the parent thinks there's been a sudden onset of squint in perhaps an older child? So as far as they're aware, everything's fine up to a certain point, but perhaps when the child's maybe 8 or 9 and they're concerned about their vision, perhaps they're closing one eye or perhaps they're squinting. Again, how would you assess that?
Yes, I mean, those children will generally complain about double vision because by and large, their vision will have developed normally up until that, hopefully. So they will be complaining of diplopia. So I think you have to be careful. Some of these need to be treated quite seriously because you have to make sure there's nothing else going wrong or there's nothing that needs onward referral. Again, I would be starting off with cover test, vision, motility and the stereo, just to give you an idea of what's going on. Sudden onset in younger children, that tends to be an urgent assessment. If somebody rang up and said it suddenly happened, I would want to see that child urgently.
So if a child has had normal binocular vision before, mm-hmm. and we assume they've therefore had good stereo acuity, mm-hmm. if they're now starting to have an issue and starting to squint, what level of stereo acuity would you expect them to have? Is it just reduced or would you expect it to be the same?
For example, somebody came in and they had broken down into an esotropia and you refract them and you may be fine. They were an uncorrected +5 and you put the +5 up. They should really be back up to normal stereo. And that's a good way to check that when you've got them in their glasses, if they have a good level of stereo vision with the glasses on, that will be the lock and the key to hold them straight. So that gives you a certain level of reassurance that you're getting it right and you can monitor the child going forward with that.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we're exploring the topics that matter the most to us optometrists, and that's where we want to hear from you. So email podcast@docket.info or tweet @soundoptometry. I'm joined by specialist optometrist for the Belfast Health Trust, Janice McCrudden. So how do we manage binocular vision issues in children? And actually, when should we be referring?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to manage. What's very easy to manage in practice might be a latent deviation where it's really down to a prescription or if you've got a fully accommodative esotropia. So again, take all your measurements with your vision, your cover test, your stereo, and then you go on to your refraction. And make sure when you're prescribing, you never ever undercorrect a positive error. For your esotropias, you want to give them maximum plus. And then obviously if you've got an exo, you want to give them minimum plus. But the vast majority of children will be esos. And also check if you have a large phoria. They may, you know, check that those patients don't have a little bit of plus. So you want to be able to manage these and you'll be putting them in their full prescription. I would be quite content bringing them back in about 4 months, rechecking vision, hopefully it's starting to improve. Rechecking stereo, again, you should start to see that improving if the glasses are working. If the vision's improving, keep them in practice, keep watching them. If you get to a point where the vision's not improving and one eye is starting to fall behind, that's maybe where you would start to think about referring off into the hospital.
If a child has unequal acuity at the beginning, at first presentation, for example, do you think we should be referring at that point for orthoptics? Because potentially they might need patching straight away.
Well, patching never really occurs straight away unless there's a massive, massive difference. But generally, it's full prescription. It will be, make sure you've got your full prescription, which is your 1% cyclopentolate, and make sure you've left it 15, 20 minutes to fully take effect. Check for sills as well, that you haven't missed out on any cylinder component of the prescription. You need to give the eye time to adapt and improve with the spectacles and get the vision clear. You just wouldn't be patching straight away.
Mm. Because I think some practitioners might be tempted to cycloplege, put this child into spectacles and refer in the meantime, knowing that it may take a few months for the child to get seen within the hospital system by an orthoptist.
I mean, I think that's quite reasonable, but don't hold back. If it's a +6, give the child the +6 and refer them in. We get some referrals in when they, oh, I think it's a high plus, I didn't want to give this much. So I'm referring them in. Do your cycloplegic and give them the full prescription. Get them to wear them full time. That's the thing. A lot of people say, oh, just wear them at school or when you're reading or in your PlayStation. Put children in glasses full time, and that gives them the best chance of their vision developing.
So that's quite often the younger child. But what about with slightly older children that don't necessarily have a manifest squint, but perhaps it's just a latent deviation or a phoria? What tends to be the most common?
I think a lot of those come in with large forays that are breaking down then into atropia. That's what we mean by latent. It's generally an uncorrected refractive error, or perhaps somebody's only been partially corrected. You know, when they're doing a lot of schoolwork, they've got a little bit older, there's a little bit more of intense close work, they will break down. So I think from those point of view, you need to check your cover test again, and don't be afraid to cyclo a 6 or 7 year old. If you think, you know, you've got a larger movement than you like, or maybe it's not as smooth as you'd like, and give the full prescription and see if that controls them. And your plus one blur test will give you an idea as well. You've got the full prescription.
What about convergence insufficiency? Because some children start to become symptomatic when they do start to do a lot of schoolwork, don't they?
Yes. And the more close work and screen use, etc., coming up to exams, that can happen. That tends to be the time that we get convergence insufficiency. And they sometimes complain about difficulty reading also with that. Obviously, your convergence insufficiency is an exo that breaks down. And when you're trying to measure a near point of convergence, tends to be greater than 10. And I just manage these simply with exercises. The pen to nose, the push-up test is still the go-to. Don't be thinking like a plus 050, a plus 075 is going to help these. In fact, it's most likely to make these worse, because remember, the more you accommodate, you will actually pull these things in. So if you start to give somebody a plus 050 prescription to try and help a convergence problem, you're making things worse. You want to develop the medial recti. I tend to say a pen, bring it into your nose and do it 15 minutes every day for 5 days, and review these again in, you know, a couple of months to see how they're getting on.
Yeah. I was going to say the pen's nose exercise was always my go-to exercise when I found convergence insufficiency in practice, but I was never really sure that the patient actually did it. And it was always really difficult to follow up the patient to find out, you know, did it actually work? So I was just wondering, do you have any tips to try and make sure that a patient does comply and does do the exercise, or do you have an alternative exercise where you can monitor their progress a little bit better, perhaps?
In practice, I'm not sure that there is anything it's any better than that. The pen to nose is great, or jump convergence. You can get people to look into the distance and jump back into the pen as it's close to you. And I tend to suggest they do it more than I want them to do it. And that tends to sort of end up that they are actually doing it somewhere around the period of time you hope they will be doing it for maximum effect. The other thing I would say is don't ever start treating these patients if they're not symptomatic.
And certainly with children, they're not going to have any motivation to do an exercise if they can't see any benefit from it.
No.
That leads me on to, if you feel that the exercises aren't working or the child perhaps isn't complying, is PRISM ever actually indicated in children in cases like convergence insufficiency? Because my concern as a practitioner is that they would just adapt to that PRISM. So I always think it's an absolute no-no.
I tend to agree with you. I would say an absolute no-no. I would never prescribe PRISMs to children without sending them through an orthoptist. I wouldn't do it. I do have a colleague who works with me, was given PRISMs at a very young age for a similar problem. And she's now at about 8 or 9 PRISM diopters, can't wear contact lenses. And, you know, she's a young adult and it really impinges on her life. So they do tend to suck up the PRISMs. Now, if it was an 80-year-old who was having that problem, that's a different story. But that's a whole different lecture. But for children, I don't think PRISMs are an answer, not for an optometrist in practice.
Well, thanks for confirming that what I've been doing all along is correct.
Yeah.
So just finishing off, are there any top tips or practical tips that you can give to the practitioners that maybe don't have the benefit of working closely with an orthoptist?
I think the one thing that I think you need to perfect as an optometrist is your cover test. A nice, slow, alternate cover test. If you can do that well, you can get loads of information from that. And don't rush it. Slow it down, and an alternate cover test gives you most of the information you need. Take a good histories and symptoms. Don't forget to observe the patient. Watch them. Look at all the signs that you can see just from looking at somebody. Use your 1% cyclo. Don't think that 0.5% gives it. And if you do have to put children in glasses, make sure the frame fits well, it's comfortable, advise the parents to come back if it's slipping down their nose, it's crooked, because all of these will give you better results. I don't think you should be afraid of managing some of these things, but as long as the picture fits, fine. If something just starts to feel a little bit wrong, or they're not getting better, or mum's coming in and saying the squint's getting worse or something, I think at that point, do refer on to our orthoptic colleagues. They're much more experienced at this, but don't be afraid of doing your assessments as we've all been taught as undergrads. There's nothing mystical about binocular vision. You just need to think about it logically.
Well, it's good to know that there's no magic involved, because I think some people do think that binocular vision is an interesting and perhaps difficult art to master.
Absolutely. I mean, it always made me go pale as an undergrad, or even when you were doing your qualifying exams. And it still, I think, is the thing that puts most people in a cold sweat.
That was Janice McCrudden, specialist optometrist from Belfast Health Trust. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. If you would like more information about assessing binocular vision in practice, go to our website, docket.info, and search for Sound Optometry to find the reading materials. Listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise will gain one CT point covering ocular disease, assessment of visual function, and binocular vision. Next time, we'll be discussing the number one topic from our survey, acute red eye. I'm Michelle Hanratty, and the producer is Izzy Clark. Thanks for listening.